ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Every time we make life easier, we give something away. A click here, a quick login there. Convenience has a price. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I explore what we trade for comfort online and how to take some of it back. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hello again, Robin Williams with a Christmas present from The Science Show to you, all about one of the brightest, smartest human beings who ever lived. The books about her are titled Passionate Minds and the Enlightenment's Most Dangerous Woman. She was also responsible for the C in E equals MC squared, Emily du Châtelet. She was the one who translated Newton's revolutionary book, Principia Mathematica, into French, correcting it as she went. But there's more. This incredible story is told by Sharon Carleton.
Emily du Châtelet, writing in about 1735, pointed out the rather obvious inconsistency in so-called enlightened Europe. While championing reason and progress, the already deeply entrenched social gender inequalities were still accepted by many.
I feel all the weight of the prejudice that universally excludes women from the sciences. It is one of the contradictions of this word that has always astonished me, that there are great countries whose destiny the law permits us to rule, and yet there is no place where we are taught to think.
Emily du Châtelet and François-Marie Arouet, known to all as Voltaire, were lovers. He was about the most famous figure of the French Enlightenment as a playwright, poet, and social critic, but also as a champion of scientific ideas, which he, along with Emily, helped the educated French public to understand.
She is beautiful, and she knows how to be a friend. I swear to you, she has a genius worthy of Horace and Newton. Ah, what happiness to see you, to hear you, and what pleasure I taste in your arms. I am so fortunate to love the one I admire. You are the idol of my heart. You make all my happiness.
Philosophers have expressed a diverse range of opinions about Emily and Voltaire's relationship, both personal and professional. We'll examine their critiques later. But Emily and Voltaire did collaborate on scientific and philosophical work, which continues to have an impact today. Gabrielle Emilie Le Tonnelier de Breteuil was born in 1706 in Paris. Her father was a high-level courtier at Louis XIV's Versailles Palace. She grew up surrounded by grandeur and the elite of French political and intellectual life. She was taught Latin, Italian, Greek, and English, and had access to philosophy and science through her family's extensive library. She was intrigued by mathematics, although she would not make progress for another decade. After all, mathematics was a pursuit highly unusual for any woman of her era, especially one of aristocratic background.
Mathematics is the language in which God has written the universe. Without it, one cannot hope to grasp the harmony of the world.
On one hand, she sparkled with diamonds, sang opera until dawn, and lived her social life to the full. The other side of her was incredibly studious.
I am convinced that if I were king, I would take care to make all women study the sciences so as to prevent them from being ridiculous and so as to prevent them from wasting their lives on vain trifles.
Emily had a forte, so they say, for gambling, and applying her talent for maths, she used her winnings to buy books and lab equipment for her scientific investigations.
It is in study that one finds the greatest pleasures of the mind and the surest refuge against the disappointments of life.
Emily was fascinated by how natural laws related to free will, which led her to want to study Isaac Newton's work, but that required more advanced mathematics than she knew. However, at 18, life intervened with an arranged marriage, and before long, there were three children. She wed a man 20 years her senior, Florent Claude, the Marquis du Châtelet, in Notre Dame Cathedral, no less. After a few years, she found the frivolities of being a society wife rather boring. By chance, as she says, she met
some people who think.
This was her epiphany. It was never too late to cultivate the mind. She was now 26.
I had met some people of letters who befriended me, and I saw with extreme amazement that they took notice of me. I then began to see myself as a thinking creature.
She hired leading Parisian mathematicians as tutors, who also helped her with Newton's physics. She read voraciously in four languages. She corresponded with leading thinkers around the world. And then she met Voltaire. Emily and Voltaire shared the same passion for literature, philosophy, and especially science. Their relationship was both romantic and intellectual.
You call me to you, vast and powerful genius, Minerva of France, immortal Emily, disciple of Newton and of truth.
Emily had met a man who also respected her mind, and Voltaire found not just a lover but a scientific partner who helped shape his destiny. He was 38 and in and out of serious trouble with the French authorities for his mocking wit aimed at the unappreciative French establishment. To avoid prison, he went to stay on one of the Du Châtelet estates. So long as Emily was reasonably discreet, society accepted that aristocratic marriages were social arrangements and not based on love. The Marquis was away more often than not, fighting King Louis XV's various battles. He was a tolerant man, though, and eventually accepted Emily's love for Voltaire, and later even became friends with him.
She was born with a man's head and woman's heart. Without masters, without guides, she taught herself all that can be known. She had the genius of Newton, and she cultivated it alone, in the silence of her study.
Emily and Voltaire ended up living in a chateau in Surrey on the Du Châtelet estate in Champagne. Emily was barred from scientific academies and international travel to meet scientists and philosophers due to her gender. So she and Voltaire transformed Surrey into a haven of books, research, experiments and writing, functioning as a private study centre that attracted scholars from around Europe. Their library contained more than 20,000 books. That's more than most universities at the time.
The chateau was a place where our minds may expand freely and our labours bear fruit.
I saw her one day divide a nine-figure number by nine other figures in her head without any help, in the presence of a mathematician unable to keep up with her.
It is here that Emily du Châtelet produced her greatest work, where her experiments and detailed research cemented her reputation as a first-rate scientific and philosophical brain. And it is here where she changed the course of European intellectual life, becoming, as we'll hear, the most dangerous woman of the Enlightenment. To discuss the science and the philosophy, Dr. Robin Arianrhod, a science star in her own right. She is an affiliate in the School of Mathematics at Monash and author of the book on Emily du Châtelet, Seduced by Logic. And Dr. Andrew Janiak, Professor of Philosophy at Duke University in the US.
I fell in love with maths probably year 10 when we started doing some proofs of Euclidean geometry. I wasn't all that visual, but I loved the idea of that you could prove things. And then when, I think it was in year 11, a teacher showed us how to prove that the square root of 2 was irrational. Well, I didn't really care about that, but what I loved was the, you know, I guess I was seduced by the rigorous logic of it, the fact that you could completely prove something, absolutely. But back in those days, girls were considered inferior to boys when it came to maths and physics. So in that sense, not a lot had changed since Emily's time.
I feel all the weight of the prejudice that universally excludes women from the sciences.
And it was only years later that I did pluck up the courage and decide that I really did want to pursue higher maths. I suppose it was about the 1970s and feminist scholars were beginning to look for foremothers. You know, for the, we knew all about the forefathers of everything. And so some scholars were starting to say, well, okay, were there any women in history who did great things? And in particular, for me, were there any scientific women? And that's how I discovered the existence of Emily du Châtelet. But for me, most importantly, she'd worked in the field of gravitational physics and maths, and that's what I wanted to study. And it's interesting that I actually started this study when I was living off-grid in the counterculture. So I was studying by candlelight, just as Emily would have done. So I certainly felt a kinship with her.
I'm surprised that Emily even came to your attention, given she'd almost been written out of scientific history.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, really for a century or more after her death, people were inclined to just say, well, yes, everything she did was derivative of the great men in her life, Voltaire and the mathematicians, Maupertuis and Clairaut, who she was friends with and who also gave her some tutoring. She was really kind of forgotten.
Andrew, why did you call Emily the most dangerous woman of the Enlightenment, which is also the title of your book? Why?
Emily du Châtelet lived in the middle of the 18th century in Paris, so she was at the center of Enlightenment culture. She quickly became, after some publications we'll surely discuss, the most famous woman in the Enlightenment. But in those days, the basic institutions of learning, colleges, universities, and the scientific academies in Paris and London and Berlin were exclusively male. So her fame was very threatening to the establishment because no woman had ever achieved such a level of fame before. And I think that is the primary reason she was so dangerous. But the paradoxical thing is that the men in her milieu knew she was brilliant, and they often discussed her ideas and promoted her ideas. Some of them even copied many of her ideas, which increased her fame. And then, of course, they realized how dangerous that made her because she was challenging the exclusively male intellectual order. In the end, that made her a very dangerous figure for them to deal with.
She was working at the intersection of science, metaphysics, and the debates that were going on at the time about reason, freedom, gender. Can you just explain a little bit, if you can? I know it's a broad area, what her philosophy was and why was it antagonizing or why was it so different to the philosophy that the men were then promoting?
She was interested in the nature of space and time. She was interested in what we would call scientific issues. So, for example, how do you understand the forces of nature? How do you understand Newton's theory of gravity, which was still quite new at the time? She was interested in mathematics and so on. But at the same time, she was promoting the notion that one should be an autonomous individual. She was, of course, not the only person in the Enlightenment to say that, but her position as a woman in an almost exclusively male environment made her promotion of autonomy especially striking and especially challenging, since in general, women had very little autonomy. Even aristocratic women like her, they were unable to live off on their own. They usually needed to have a husband, to be married, to raise children. There were many, many constraints on their lives. And so her promotion of autonomy was especially challenging.
Why have her philosophical contributions been overlooked for so long? As you said, she had friends in all these intellectual milieu, and yet she disappears.
She was not put into the canon of modern philosophy. So when people have studied the history of philosophy, if they go to college or university, they will learn about the Enlightenment, of course, and they'll probably read John Locke or David Hume, Immanuel Kant. The canon has been an all-male preserve for many generations. That has been severely challenged in recent years. But for certain, many, many people never read Emily du Châtelet in a philosophy class until pretty recently. That is one of the unfortunate facts about the way the history of philosophy has been taught in the Anglo-American world, and in fact, in much of continental Europe as well. So although she was never forgotten, she wasn't part of the canon and wasn't part of university curricula when people studied philosophy and the Enlightenment.
Well, if we do go back the hundreds of years to when Emily and Voltaire were lovers and they were collaborating together, how did two such volatile people as Emily and Voltaire negotiate their relationship and their science at Surrey?
Yes, they did it with both difficulty and delight. I think at their best, no two people could have been happier or more productive. But Voltaire could drive Emily nuts because he couldn't resist writing satirical stuff that was in danger of offending the authorities. She and her husband had to plead with the authorities twice to let him live under house arrest at Cirey rather than in prison. And so every time he talked too openly with visitors whose tongues might wag to the wrong people, Emily was terrified. She took to locking up his work and checking his mail to make sure that no one was writing terrible stuff that might send him off into a fit of despair, because he was also a moody hypochondriac. So all in all, he wasn't an easy person to live with. And she could be quite imperious and controlling. I think this is where her aristocratic background came out, because, you know, she was an aristocrat and he wasn't. As far as the science went, I think it was all part and parcel of everything. I think they were real soulmates, and they were so productive and inspired each other. I think Voltaire, who had great cachet in the intellectual world, he did encourage Emily to develop her own intellect and her scholarship. And she, of course, inspired him, especially with the science, because she was more adept at that than he was. Although I think it's fascinating that he really did devote a lot of time to science. A lot of people think, well, you know, he was a poet and a satirist and a playwright, and that's enough. But he had a genuine interest in science. They were both wealthy. Voltaire was wealthy because of his writing and because of a lottery kind of scam that he'd got involved with, where they bought up a whole heap of tickets and so they won. And so they both had a lot of money, and they equipped a state-of-the-art library and laboratory. They did experiments together. They read together. They felt themselves that they were in heaven.
One must not be content to admire nature without seeking to understand its laws. Reason must guide our observations and experiments, for knowledge is the path to true wisdom.
So tell me about the production together of elements of Newton's philosophy. Why was that important at the time?
Well, it was one of the very first serious popular science books. Voltaire and Emily decided that they wanted to direct it at the educated French public and to bring to light not just Newton's meticulous experiments and discoveries on light and colour, but also the mathematically complex theory of gravity. And this was really interesting at the time, because before Newton, the leading theory about why the planets moved around the sun was that they were swept along by massive cosmic vortices or whirlpools. And this was the idea that Descartes and Leibniz had favoured. But they also realised that religion played a bit of a role. Critics mistakenly accused Newton of being a materialist, leaving no room for God, even though, of course, we now know just how religious Newton was. By the time The Elements was published in 1738, many physicists accepted Newton's theory of gravity as the best working hypothesis to explain planetary motion, but there was still quite a bit of resistance, especially on the continent. And Emily and Voltaire put this down partly to nationalism. You were for the Englishman, Newton, or for the Frenchman, Descartes, or the German, Leibniz.
Is it self-love that makes them want to have the honour of writing against a great man? Wouldn't it be more flattering to be a disciple than an adversary? Is it because they are born in France that they are embarrassed to receive the truth from an Englishman? Such sentiment is unworthy of a philosopher.
There was also the fact that the theory hadn't yet been experimentally tested with new observations. The first of these wouldn't happen a decade or two after Emily and Voltaire were writing. And there was also the troubling fact that Newton hadn't explained what gravity itself was or how it could act across millions of kilometres of empty space from the sun to the planets. And this had bothered philosophers such as Leibniz, and it still bothered his followers, because the traditional conception of a theory was that it should provide a causal mechanism for the effects it describes. So from my point of view, as a scientist rather than a philosopher, one of the most important things about The Elements is its clarification of the difference between what we now call the scientific method and the traditional philosophical method. At that time, theoretical physics was called natural philosophy because the philosophers had been the ones that had been asking questions about the nature of reality. So justifications for theories had depended on finding rational, believable causes for observed effects, which is why the cosmic vortex idea still seemed to be appropriate. But Emily and Voltaire explained really beautifully how Newton turned that on its head. And he did that by focusing on the quantitative, measurable effects of gravity. And using this data, he deduced from experimental results and mathematical principles the law of gravity. And then from that, he was able to deduce further testable consequences, such as when would Halley's Comet return and what was the shape of the Earth and so on. And by contrast, the cosmic whirlpools were completely undetectable, and the only so-called empirical evidence for them was the fact of planetary motion. But Emily and Voltaire explained that any number of hypotheses could explain, in inverted commas, this motion. And so they really showed why that traditional method was flawed.
Andrew, I know you have certain reservations about Emily's relationship with Voltaire, but those first years at Suresnes were hugely important, surely, especially to her philosophical ideas.
Yes, that's a very fair point. I admit that for many years I was trying to study and teach Emily du Châtelet without mentioning Voltaire, partly because I was trying to present a corrective to the rather prurient interest people often have in her relationship with Voltaire. To be honest, people are often discussing the fact that she was his mistress, that they had an affair and things like that. But in fact, those are historically quite inaccurate ideas. Nothing they did was illicit. In fact, her husband, the Marquis de Châtelet, knew that they were moving to Cirey, as you say, the famous chateau. But just as importantly, it is true that her intellectual life was formed in connection to Voltaire and also in response to Voltaire. So they were both writing and publishing important works in the 1730s and into the early 1740s. And I simply want to emphasize her promotion of autonomy and her status as an autonomous thinker and not focus too much on her relation to Voltaire, which in many accounts of her life has made her seem like a kind of side player in the Enlightenment.
Emily famously said, "The mind has no sex." How does that resonate today, perhaps with feminist philosophy, say?
I think it's a fascinating issue to ask about Emily du Châtelet in the history of feminism. Of course, one has to be cautious in using that notion when talking about the 18th century, because in some views anyway, feminism really arose in the 19th century. But there's no doubt whatsoever that Du Châtelet was bemoaning the fact that women were excluded from educational institutions. They were excluded from the liberal arts and from studying the sciences. She herself broke through many of those barriers, despite the fact, for instance, that she could not join the Academy of Sciences in France. She managed to get the secretary of the academy, a very powerful figure at the time, to have a public dispute with her. So she was showing the world that despite the fact that the academy excluded women, she was perfectly capable of having an intellectual debate with the head of the academy. And that was a very powerful signal to women all over Europe. And she certainly became very famous and was respected and promoted by women in later parts of the 18th century, and of course, much more recently as well.
So tell me then about the Academy's competition and her essay on fire, because that led to her being the first woman ever to have a scientific paper published in her own name in France.
That was a little bit before the event that I just mentioned, where she had a public dispute with the head of the Academy. But before that happened, in 1738, Du Châtelet and Voltaire, actually, both entered a prize competition about the nature of fire. Now, this is a very important element of the Enlightenment. There were many such prize competitions held by academies in Berlin, for example, St. Petersburg, and Paris. And they would really allow intellectuals and writers and mathematicians to show off their best thinking to the kind of learned world. She wrote a very long dissertation on the nature of fire, as you mentioned, and it really discusses a very wide range of scientific issues. And it's not just about fire in our sense, but it's about heat and the nature of heat and how we should understand it scientifically, how we should measure it. And in those days, those topics were not very well understood. There was still a lot of disputes about that.
Andrew, you just said that she and Voltaire entered the competition, but they gave completely different essays. And didn't she keep her secret from her lover?
Yes. And that's a really fascinating moment, too. I have always thought there should be a movie about her life because it has so much drama. You wouldn't need to add or embellish anything. So one of the wonderful scenes in such a movie would show her furiously writing away in her own room, discussing the nature of fire and how to measure heat and that sort of thing. And Voltaire in the same chateau in his room, writing an essay on the same topic.
That's really a lovely interlude because it showcases Emily's independent scientific thinking in contrast to Voltaire's. Voltaire was starstruck by Newton. He was so impressed with his experiments on light and his Principia that he really just followed him no matter what he said. When it came to light or fire, he was a devotee of Newton's book Optics, and that's where he had described all his meticulous experiments about light and, you know, shown that white light was made up of the separate colours rather than colour being seen as an impurity in the bodies that, you know, the material of the objects that it struck, and that light itself was white. So things like that were very big. But Newton didn't have a theory for how light actually worked, and so he didn't speculate because, you know, he didn't do that unless he was pretty sure of himself and backed up by data. But what he did do at the end of Optics was he set out a list of queries and tentative hypotheses about light, including the possibility that it was a luminous material particle and therefore subject to gravity. And at the time, it was also generally assumed that heat was a material substance called caloric, and each body was supposed to have specific amounts of it. So in the essay competition, Voltaire's big pitch involved trying to prove that heat, and presumably light, did indeed have weight. And to do this, he measured tons and tons of iron before and after it was heated in the forge at Cirey, trying to see if it weighed more after it was heated than it did before. And that, he hoped, would show that heat really was a material substance added to the metal by the fire. But Emily said, well, how do you know whether you're measuring the weight of the increased heat or of the extraneous particles of charcoal? And you don't seem to be getting any definitive results anyway. So she started to think that what Voltaire was actually showing was that heat and light had no weight. And Voltaire wouldn't listen to her objections. He was so passionately Newtonian. So that's why she decided to enter the competition herself.
Fire is matter. Therefore, it has weight. And light is nothing but fire.
Fire has no weight. Or if it does, it can never be perceived by us.
And she did it anonymously because a woman would likely have been laughed out of contention. And she did it secretly so as not to hurt Voltaire's feelings by disagreeing with him.
And she did it with dyed sheets.
Oh, I know. It was amazing. I mean, the secrecy meant that she couldn't go and perform any large-scale experiments like Voltaire was doing. So she came up with a couple of brilliant ones that she did in her rooms. And one in particular, the bedsheet one, she'd been struck by the fact that black cloth dries faster than a similar white cloth. And we know that white things reflect back white light, which, as Newton showed, contained all the colours of the rainbow, while black things absorb all the light, all the energy, and that's why they dry faster. And Emily understood this basic idea, and she wondered if the different colours of the spectrum were also associated with different amounts of heat. And to investigate the idea, she dyed different parts of a bedsheet with the different colours of the spectrum. And then she wet it and let it dry in front of a well-stoked fire and timed how long it took each colour to dry. And she found that violet dried first, and then, indeed, all the other colours in order, with red taking the longest. And actually, it's interesting because although her explanation was a bit confused, her experimental result was correct, and her hypothesis that red would feel the warmest was right. She wasn't able to measure the temperatures directly herself. That wouldn't be done for another few decades. It was a very cutting-edge idea, and eventually her identity was discovered by some of her friends in the Academy, and although neither she nor Voltaire won the competition, the Academy decided that their essays were original enough and surprising enough, being from a lady and from France's greatest poet, to be published as runners-up. So in this way, Emily became the first woman to have a paper published in the prestigious proceedings of the French Academy of Science.
And on such a primitive sounding now, such a primitive way of experimenting on dyed sheets. I think it's wonderful.
It is wonderful, isn't it? You know, this is where you can really see that she's independently thinking. She's not swayed by Voltaire, but she's not even swayed by Newton.
The Discourse on Happiness is a fascinating essay, and it might be her most famous work. It's been translated into numerous languages over the years and has been published many times. It's a very short piece. I highly recommend reading it.
The pursuit of happiness is the most important concern of all human beings and the one that absorbs all others. To be happy, we must rid ourselves of prejudice, cultivate our reason, and find the passions that can lead us to contentment.
One of the things she tries to explain is the role that illusions play in generating happiness. This is quite a surprising idea for a rationalist like her, if you want to use that word, a scientist, a mathematician, a philosopher. But she said that illusions can help us to achieve happiness. And she gives a lovely example. When you go to the opera or the theater, you have to be carried away by the illusion of what's happening. So, of course, you know that maybe this person isn't really flying. There are some wires behind the stage, but you get caught up in the illusion in the theater, and that can generate happiness. And as always, she's challenging our assumptions about what someone like her would say in a situation like that.
Would she have anything to say in this Discourse on Happiness, her recipe, about the gloom that seems to have descended on the world, or at least the Western world at the moment?
For certain, there is relevance. She did say that you should, to the extent possible, try to think of the things that are under your control, and you can try to imagine being happy within those things. And of course, many things are beyond our control.
Her Foundations of Physics was actually her first really major work. You called it a revolution in the sciences.
First published in 1740 in Paris. This is a monumental work on the status of scientific knowledge in her day, the nature of space and time and matter, how to understand the forces of nature. It was extremely unusual for a woman to publish a philosophical treatise like that. The first edition was anonymous, but after she had the famous debate with the secretary of the Academy of Sciences, as I mentioned, she then had a second edition quickly published a year later, and that was under her own name. Even more amazingly, it was then translated into both German and Italian so that scholars and intellectually minded readers all over Europe could read her work in French, German, or Italian. And then her ideas really spread like wildfire.
And as she tried, as I understand it, to integrate Newtonian, Cartesian, and Leibnizian views.
If I could explain it in the most straightforward way, the problem that people had in the 18th century, let's say in the 1730s, is that the two greatest mathematicians of the scientific revolution, Leibniz and Newton, both of whom discovered the calculus, as every high school student learns, had very different views about space and time and force, very different views in physics. So Newton was famous for discovering the theory of universal gravity, but Leibniz and many other figures in this era rejected the idea of action at a distance. They thought there must be some mechanical interaction that keeps things going in the planetary system. So they were sort of mechanistic philosophers. That's what they were called at the time. So the great problem was, well, which one is right? Or is there a way of reconciling them? And Du Châtelet took this challenge head on and tried to show that there were ways of reconciling these two different ideas. But she was very cautious in the way that she did it. Instead of thinking that in her day, which was around 1740, everything had been figured out, for example, about the nature of gravity, she often said, we have to be humble about the lack of our knowledge, and we don't fully understand the way gravity works. So in a way, neither Newton or the Newtonians, who thought action at a distance happened, nor the Leibnizians, who thought there must be a mechanism, had the final word. More research had to be done.
Wow, that's quite some lady having the nerve to critique and criticize such famous people.
In the scientific context, one of the most important aspects of that book was her engagement with Leibniz's idea of vis viva, or living force, as he called it. This is the concept that later became known as kinetic energy. And he had a formula for this concept, which he'd mostly derived quite intuitively. And it was slightly different from the formula for momentum, which was a Cartesian and Newtonian concept. And so there'd been some debate about which one was the true measure of force. Newton actually defined force clearly, and neither momentum nor kinetic energy are forces, as we now know. Emily reinvigorated this debate because she thought it was such an interesting idea. In fact, actually, Newton also had the same concept, but it was buried within the theorems of Principia, and it didn't actually come to light for another 150 years or so. And a really interesting little footnote to the essay on fire, once she discovered this formula for kinetic energy, she realized that it gave her a justification for her idea that light didn't have any weight, because she calculated that because of light's great speed, if a light particle was hitting our eyes, it would feel like a cannonball, even if its mass were 2.7 trillion times smaller than a cannonball. Again, a really kind of cute little argument that isn't enough to justify anything, but certainly shed light on her thinking and shows the way she was able to take ideas and develop possible consequences of them.
Emily's probably best remembered for the French translation of Newton's Principia, because I gather it's still used today. But how significant was she as a translator or as someone who commented on it?
In many discussions of the history of science or even French history, if she's mentioned, one of the first things that will be said, sometimes the only thing that will be said, is that she translated Newton's Principia into French. That's a monumental achievement. For those of us who have tried to read Newton's Principia, it's hundreds and hundreds of pages written purely in geometry and Latin. And she translated the entire thing into French, and it's still the standard translation in French today, as far as I know. So that's quite an achievement. But at the same time, she also wanted to maintain her independence. She was definitely promoting autonomy as an important intellectual stance. So even when she was the translator of Newton's Principia, she wrote two very long essays that she appended to the translation. One of them was about the latest research in physics that extended some of Newton's work. And the other was basically trying to take Newton's geometrical methods and to use more modern, so to speak, analytical methods. She had her own voice, even when she was also acting as a translator of somebody else's ideas.
It is indeed the definitive French version. Perhaps one of the most important things that she did there was to actually synthesize the structure of Newton's derivation of the theory of gravity, something that he'd taken many propositions and proofs to do, scattered over hundreds of pages. He did outline for his readers which propositions they needed to know, but she really took that on and expanded it and gave a coherent account of the structure of his proof, or derivation, should I say. She also added updates on gravitation since Newton's time, as well as the fact that she translated Newton himself from Latin into French, and that was the first translation into an everyday language outside of Britain. So it made Newtonian physics more accessible to a continental audience. One of the most interesting things too for me is that she added 70 pages of reworked calculus proofs, translating Newton's geometrical approach into algebraic language and Leibnizian symbolism. Newton had co-invented the algorithms of calculus with Leibniz. He was aware that it was still on, in some ways, shaky ground. It was such a new concept for a start. It involved using infinitesimals, and that wouldn't really be made mathematically rigorous until the 19th century with the theory of limits. So he was aware that maybe people wouldn't take kindly to him developing a theory that was using this newfangled language. And so he did his most of his proofs, even when they were calculus algorithms, using idiosyncratic, incredibly ingenious geometrical calculations. And people complained later, how could you then apply his thinking to anything else? He was just so brilliant and so idiosyncratic. So one of the things that Emily did was to rework a whole bunch of those geometrical proofs into algebraic calculus.
What happened that we forgot, that history, science history, forgot this utterly brilliant woman, Emily du Châtelet?
Well, I think partly she died too young and she hadn't fulfilled all her potential. Even her translation of Principia wasn't published at the time she died, and it was another 10 years, actually, before it was. And it wasn't until the 1940s that some new manuscripts were discovered that showed not only her independent thinking, and we've talked about this with the essay on fire and the her fundamentals of physics in particular, but also the notes she made on Voltaire's work showing that she had been contributing to his work. So I think she was a victim of sexism, pure and simple.
After Emily and Voltaire's love affair came to an end, though not their friendship, Emily began another relationship and became pregnant. Her ever-tolerant husband stood by her and accepted the child as his own. Emily du Châtelet died, as she had feared, in childbirth in 1749. She was 42 years old.
She was surely the most glamorous female mathematician in history, tall and aristocratic, passionate in both her intellectual and amorous pursuits. She was larger than life, too large for most people at the time, too ambitious, too intellectual, too emotional, and too sexually liberated. Too much of a feminist, too. Women were denied access to good schools, let alone universities, and she pulled no punches when writing of her struggle to educate herself in higher mathematics and physics.
One must choose in life between boredom and suffering, and I chose study. In the life of the mind, I found both joy and freedom. What endures of us is not fortune or fashion, but the truth we have sought and the light we have added, however small, to human understanding.
Madame du Châtelet was a great man whose only fault was being a woman.
A woman, yes, and the two books on her I mentioned are Passionate Minds by David Badanis and The Enlightenment's Most Dangerous Woman by Andrew Janiak. And that Science Show feature was by the enlightened Sharon Carleton. Emily, so many talents, but as we've shown in the Science Show this year and more, there are many, many such. So to end, let me introduce Dr. Rena Fu from Curtin University in Perth, who's just won the West Australian Premier's Award for Science Communication. She's a doctor, singer, artist and teacher, but also a delightful speaker. And here she is. And Dr. Rena, I'm looking at your portfolio, your book, in fact, and in it I see pictures of you singing. Are you really a singing scientist?
I can sing and I am a qualified scientist, so putting them together, that's a yes.
What do you sing?
I can sing original songs about science and I can sing songs praising God and I can sing love songs too. And a rap, not very well.
You rap. And here's another picture of you and you're on the top of a very large crocodile and that's somewhat on the landscape. I can't see any river by it. It didn't eat you, did it?
No, I got to it first. Obviously, I was on top. We're just having a little chat.
I see. Mm. Was it in any way living?
No, not really. That was during my visit to the Northern Territory.
So that's the big crocodile, is it?
It's a gigantic model of it, and there are live ones around because I did some crocodile collagen research.
Crocodile collagen, really?
Yeah.
We've got collagen in our interstitial tissues and knees and various other places like that. And lots of sharks have got collagen as well. Where have crocodiles got it?
Well, collagen is a universal structural protein, so all animals will have it and humans as well. And crocodiles will have collagen in their skin, in their bones, in their cartilage. And where we were the first group to actually extract and isolate the collagen from their rib cartilage and try to characterize it.
To see what different sorts of collagen they've got.
Perhaps, yeah. So we also wanted to see if it's a viable new source for collagen because there's a big market for nutraceutical and cosmeceutical needs. So we're seeing if we can turn some of the carcass material that is a product that's of a higher value to help with the economy and also to appreciate knowledge of the indigenous rangers because they get the eggs from the wild and they reed them and then they supply the crop farms.
Yeah. So you look widely into nature. It reminds me a little bit of a marine scientist who works on the south coast of New South Wales and she grows seaweed. Mm. And from seaweed there are various ingredients, surprisingly enough, which some medical people, such as Fiona Wood in Perth, spray on skin, use this in... Is that a kind of collagen association?
I think it might be some kind of maybe alginate of some sort because my little boy was actually in ED for 5 days with severe burn and we had the privilege of being treated by Professor Fiona Wood, so, and she was my hero in many ways.
It says here in framed wonderful tribute, the Australian Society for Parasitology, the Bridget Ogilvie Medal of the Australian Society for Parasitology awarded to Rena Fong. Now, the point about Bridget Ogilvie is she's one, not just an Australian hero, she is really a world hero for what she's done for parasitology, for malaria, all sorts of things. And she has raised more money in time when she was head of the Wellcome Foundation in London. Mm-hmm. And she raised more money than the whole of the British government for medical research. And she's an Australian. She came from Glen Innes in New South Wales and went to Armidale, to University of New England. And you've got the medal from her. Was she there giving it or not?
She wasn't able to make it. We did have members from the Australian Society for Parasitology texting to see whether she would come to Melbourne for a trip. That's where I received it. It's just such an honour, particularly with my own PhD research in malaria drug resistance and having that link and to see a woman, particularly in those days would need to have overcome so much more barrier to be strong in science, and that didn't get in the way of her drive, her passion to make science accessible, not only to excel in herself as a role model, but to make it possible through providing medical research funding, which is so needed, and to be an inspiration to the broader community.
She's one of my top 100 Australian scientists of all time, and you can just put the Australian in brackets and make it the world. She's at that level of brilliance, yes. Now, you got your final award, of course, from the Premier of Western Australia. What was the citation there?
Yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled with receiving the Premier Science Awards as the STEM Educator of the Year for tertiary education. And I guess my specialty is using different ways to make science accessible and fun, particularly multimodal engagement. Whether it's, you mentioned, do you really sing? Yes, so I could be using songs to talk about malaria drug resistance, and I perform that for my students so they don't fall asleep in my lecture. No. And also using storybooks and making animations about cells and nasty microbes.
That all? Where did you get the inspiration to be that innovative?
When I think back to my childhood, my mum worked as a theatre nurse, and I really value when mum is able to be home and tuck me in bed, because often she has to do overnight shift. But when she does, and she would share stories with me, and I remember she talked about the journey of her peanuts going into my mouth, and then she would talk about it through the digestive system down to your esophagus, into the stomach, and then there's churning and different pieces of muscles. But the way she describes it is from the point of view of the peanuts. But you actually learn about anatomy through that way. And it's like, oh, you look out and you see the very tall finger-like projections, and now I know them to be villi in the intestine. So I was really hooked about how the human's body function as a young child who was probably about 5 at the time. And I would imagine, you know, what would it be like living inside the human body? Or at least I find all the facts about the human body very wonderful and amazing.
And now your actual research is in what direction?
So I've got a few industry-linked projects happening. So one of them is characterising the crocodile collagen, whether there's any effects on wound healing, so that kind of medical application. There's another one where we've designed a nanoformulation of Australian tea tree oil and looking at the virus killing and bacteria killing. We know it kills bacteria, but not much work has been done for viruses, and you know how useful it could be as a service disinfectant, so more natural slant on that. And we've also currently hoping to explore opportunities to look at cancer and microbiome, that direction, applying for grants. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
That's quite a lot, really. And how many, is it something like 24 months a year?
24 months a year, yeah, and probably need more than 24 hours, yeah, in a day.
And here you are at Curtin University, dealing presumably directly with students.
So I've taught across 3 universities in WA. You do have students who want to really just focus on, tell me the content, tell me what's in the test. But I'm finding when you're able to do something a little bit different in the way you share your lecture, you really get them excited or curious about the subject. And that's my, you know, my light bulb moment, or seeing their light bulb moment. And I get a kick out of it when that moment happens as an educator.
Congratulations on your award.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Rena Fu, there seem to be no limits to her talents and charm. Her book for kids is My Mad Scientist Mummy, containing one of her songs even. Next week, the Science Show Party on Turning 50. I'm Robin Williams.
been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.